This session of the 2013 Adelaide Festival of Ideas was recorded by Radio Adelaide through the support of the Bar Smith Library, University of Adelaide, the University of South Australia Library and Flinders University Library.
Hello, I'm Stan Marnie. I'm the Director of the Festival and Popular Culture. This is a harebrained pet project of mine. We'll get to that in a little bit. But first of all, welcome to the Adelaide Festival of Ideas. Today's session, for starters, They Probably Don't Have Eyes, co-presented by the Festival on Popular Culture. My guests today are, to my immediate right, Stephen Pickles, better known as Pix. He is a founding member of Hackerspace Adelaide. After his computer science degree, Pix fell in with the wrong crowd and spent the better part of a decade helping artists build interactive installations for the European New Media Art Festival circuit. His work has given him a unique perspective on the relationship between technology and the arts, backed up by an enduring fascination with all things geeky. To his right, Sean Williams, number one New York Times best-selling author with 40 novels, 80 short stories, the odd poem, and even a sci-fi musical under his belt. He writes for adults, young adults, and children, and enjoys the occasional franchise too, such as Star Wars and Doctor Who. Never heard of either of those franchises. Doctor Who? His work has won awards, including the Essay Great Literature Award, debuted at number one on the New York Times bestseller list, and has been translated into numerous languages. His latest series are Trouble Twisters, co-written with Garth Nix, and Twin Maker, which is available for the first time ever, I believe, in the bookshop upstairs.
2 weeks ahead of everywhere else, which I'm very excited about.
Stick with us, folks. So, to begin with, are there any real astrobiologists in the crowd today? Okay, good. It's quite a relief. So, ostensibly, this discussion is about intelligent alien life and how utterly unlike human life it is likely to be. However, I'd like to turn much of the conversation towards how an outsider would view human culture, evolutionary psychology, and, pause for effect, strawberry cheesecake. To start with, we can turn our attention to evolutionary psychologist Dr. Steven Pinker, who sees human culture as maladaptive, pointless, trivial, empty calories, if you will. To quote Dr. Pinker, we enjoy strawberry cheesecake, but not because we evolved a taste for it. We evolved circuits that give us trickles of enjoyment from the sweet taste of ripe fruit, the creamy mouthfeel of fats and oils from nuts and meat, and the coolness of fresh water. Cheesecake packs a sensual wallop. Unlike anything in the natural world, because it is a brew of mega doses of agreeable stimuli which we concocted for the express purpose of pressing our pleasure buttons. Pornography is another pleasure technology. The arts are a third. He's effectively saying that the arts and all human culture is cheesecake, is a byproduct incidental to our evolution. Sean Williams, perhaps I'll start with you.
Because I produce quite a large intelligent, amount of cheesecake.
Yeah.
I eat a large amount of cheesecake.
Intelligent aliens, as advanced as they are, have they not outgrown strawberry cheesecake?
Without wanting to get into philosophy, I think there's an inherent value in cheesecake that extends beyond its utility to us as reproducing biological units programmed in particular ways. I think that wonderful, magnificent extrusion of complexity that is a good cheesecake can symbolise our entire culture. I mean, ideally, Steven Pinker is irrelevant, is a piece of cheesecake by his argument, except for his basest biological functions, which are reproduction, ingestion, excretion, death.
So our culture is our identity.
I think that to a large degree, what makes us human, and I think most people would agree with this, is the books we read, the music we listen to, the cheesecakes we eat, the sports we play, the songs we sing, that's music to us, the clothes we wear, the hairstyles we have. That's kind of everything that makes us human. And I think Pinker is actually completely right. But but perhaps completely wrong at the same time. I mean, a cheesecake is essentially meaningless to anybody looking at it from the outside, but to us, it is everything that has meaning. Take away our cheesecake and we are nothing.
I suppose if you take his argument to its logical conclusion, it would be best to be nothing. It would be best for us all to lose our identity and be as one. Is that not the logical conclusion of intelligent life or extraterrestrial life?
Or get really good at making cheesecake.
Well, yes.
We should be searching for cheesecakes in outer space, I think. A giant... What kind of sort of ultraviolet emission would they be releasing? A giant cheesecake orbiting us?
Well, if we're searching for microbial life, you know, we found evidence of cheese on other planets. It's just that close to cheesecake.
So we need liquid water and oxygen for life, but we need saturated fat for culture. That's the kind of wavelengths that we're looking for.
Yes.
Oh.
The pun wars have begun.
You just rimshot me. I deserved that. Well, Stephen Pickles, you've worked in the creative sector for some time now, working with artists, as illogical as they are. Do you sometimes feel that human art seems trivial compared to the cold mathematics to science and to more logical applications for technology? That's a no.
Yeah.
For our listeners out there, he's shaking his head.
Yeah, okay.
For those listening on the radio, Pix is now miming his answer.
Yes, exactly. through eyebrow signs.
So does
art seem trivial compared to mathematics?
Yes. Do you sometimes...
I used to live very much inside my head, and I thought that was it. You know, it was all just maths and science. And although I can't really put that much behind it, there was some point when I finally kind of got just the whiff of the possibility that the particular way in which we deal with mathematics could be peculiarly human. And then all that idea of, you know, oh, it's all just about mathematics and, you know, where, you know, the universe expressing computational and intelligent ability just sort of fell down a little bit. We might just be with this weird little cul-de-sac of something computation-like that the universe started doing.
Right, right. So we're a victim of our own programming in a way. And perhaps the aliens have transcended it.
I don't know. Not even getting to aliens yet, but just trying to work out whether disassemble that idea that logic and mathematics are somehow the highest thing that we've ever achieved. It might actually be just a little bit of a side story that we're playing around with. It's useful, but you know, it might not be. We're not necessarily tapping into some fundamental knowledge of the universe. It just might be our way of feeling like we are.
It is very, very hard to see past the human. I mean, we are humans trying to imagine things beyond humanity, whether it's logic or whatever. And there are lots of sort of feedback loops we can imagine. And when we are the genes, means of reproducing more genes. We are the great cheesecakes means of great making more cheesecakes. We are, we could be, as humans, we could be imagining logic that is essentially coloured by our own humanity. And it's almost impossible to tease that thread out of any kind of observation we want to make about ourselves or about anything. But this is where the ideas of aliens, I think, are so interesting. I mean, to imagine what logic might look like to an alien, what their pleasure hits that their biological wiring may be delivering to them, what they look like, is, you know, maybe our greatest purpose as intelligent beings is not so much to discover the secrets of logic or cheesecake or art, but it's to finally stand outside ourselves and understand not just the universe, but ourselves completely.
That is what I like about the idea of aliens, plausible or otherwise. E.T. is more of a thought experiment. I like to think of E.T. as just an experiment of how we should look at ourselves without the mud and muck of our own culture. Do you find as a writer you have to think, the aliens are a useful way of, you know, stripping away the character of a civilization or an individual, looking at it from an outsider's perspective, separate from the culture?
Aliens perform lots of different functions in science fiction, of course, because they play lots of different roles. I mean, the aliens in, say, Babylon 5 exist solely as, you know, there's a particular race that behaves a particular way, a particular class of human behaviour. Another alien might just... So they're kind of mirrors of looking at the self, which is kind of what you're talking about, isn't it, Stan? That it's a way of holding up something to humanity to say, you think this is weird, but we do this all the time. You know, we as humans do this all the time. And but it's also, it can also be, aliens can also just be simply a way of making a story more interesting, both for the writer and the reader, providing a bit of strange colour, like the cantina scene in Star Wars, you know, one of the most famous alien scenes ever. You don't know anything about the culture of these aliens. They're just there to make the movie look good. But later, people did go back and imagine what the cultures of these aliens were like. There was a very famous collection of short stories where each of the aliens that you see for like a nanosecond gets their own backstory, their own culture. And I like that. Again, it's another kind of feedback loop. But in my stories, they perform all sorts of functions. I mean, sometimes they're jokes. Sometimes I've got, in one of my Star Wars novels, there's a series of aliens that I thought would never get through the editors. They're basically shaped like giant starfish, or more, if you've read, I think it's Cat's Cradle by Kurt Vonnegut, he draws a picture of his asshole, and it looks like a starfish. It looks exactly like that. And the name of these aliens is kind of like a noise. So I have this really juvenile alien in a Star Wars novel that has now become canon. And it was just there for a joke, and I thought nobody would let it go through. But suddenly it's canon. So sometimes they're just a way of making things more interesting. Because you get boring, humans get boring after a while, I think. Which is, you know, the most facile thing you could possibly say. Because there's nothing more alien than to me than anybody else in this room. You never know anybody completely. But so aliens perform lots of roles in science fiction. And
but don't you think that aliens that
we
create are very human?
Yeah, well, because they're filtered through us. Some writers do make amazing aliens. Greg Egan's aliens are incredibly strange and peculiar. Larry Niven's done some interesting ones. But again, as soon as you give them our language and personality, emotions that we can understand, then either they are as human as a fictional thing on a piece of paper can be, or we perceive them as human, which is a different thing, but no less real in effect. It's hard.
Well, I think that is the problem. I mean, you must be sick of a certain species of nerd who are picking apart the implausible nature of, you know, the conventional idea of an alien.
I am that species of nerd. I love that species of nerd.
But do you tire of people saying, you couldn't hear that explosion in space? Aliens wouldn't possibly speak English. Those criticisms, are they missing the point, or are they...
There are lots of different points. I mean, the reader brings all sorts of things to any work of fiction or TV or any kind of art form, and each is equally valid. I mean, if me having an alien speaking English drops somebody out of the story, then that is something that was wrong for them, and that's valid. But, you know, sometimes I don't let it worry me as a writer, because otherwise, if you're trying to make everything as real as possible in an area where there are no hard facts to go by at all, or in fact, if you're going to be completely real, you wouldn't write any aliens at all because we've never seen one. So I think you've been things a little bit. But I have been dropped out of stories by aliens that don't feel alien enough.
Right.
Okay. I mean, you guys probably have too, I'm sure. You know, there are moments in every science fiction story where you go, that's just, you've just gone too far.
They're just puppets in outer space. Yeah. Oh, that was Farscape.
Or Muppets, like in Farscape.
Yeah. Yes, do you have a problem with that plausibility gap, or do you think it's just something that you have to suspend now and then?
Oh, in terms of sci-fi, I mean, I'm not an avid reader of sci-fi, but definitely in the context that you're talking about, it's really just a device for telling a story, and often it's the version of making the mirror of a humankind, and so it's just this convenient thing. It's one of the many tools that you have when you sort of take on the toolkit of sci-fi. Oh, how do we do this? Oh, yeah, we can just throw an alien species in there that does that. For example, if you wanted to have sci-fi that was definitely looking at humans, then you would be more paying attention to the observations of the aliens, and then it would be about humanity, but you'd be using the aliens as a convenient external perspective.
Mm. Or the reverse, I suppose, which we'll get to later, which is aliens trying to summarise, or humans trying to summarise themselves for the benefit of aliens who don't understand a modicum of human culture. But we'll get to that.
Okay. I'm skipping ahead.
No, I'm skipping ahead. My apologies. Now, having said all of that, let's suspend our suspension of disbelief and have some fun dismantling everything we can about the normal, about that conventional idea of little green men. I'll go to a really embarrassing anecdote. I was at a sort of an art exhibition recently, which was riffing off of the idea of the Voyager records, which I'm sure most of you are familiar with. In the early 70s, NASA commissioned a series of artworks which were to be encoded onto a phonograph-style record, which was attached to the Voyager and Pioneer probes before that and sent out into deep space.
The record is only on the Voyager ones.
Really?
Yeah.
Pioneer had a record, though.
No, it was...
Oh, no, it just had the naked man with the
hands in the air. Yeah, that was the one with the porn.
There aren't any scientists in the audience, are there? Good. So this exhibition was quite interesting. It involved people trying to summarize human culture, trying to explain from their own personal perspectives what they think the aliens should know about the human race. And in theory, that was going to be sent or beamed somehow into... cosmos. I was grumpy. It was late on a Sunday night. I was stuck in Port Adelaide. So I went up to one of the curators who happened to be the bass player for the Violent Femmes, who's now one of the directors of MONA, the Museum of Older New Art in Tasmania. Fantastic institution. And I just wanted an excuse to fawn over my, you know, childhood rock and roll idol. So... Oh, my apologies. The director of MONA FOMA. Yeah, okay. I've been bluffing the whole time, and that's the first time that somebody's called me out. my way of fawning over this man was pointing out everything that was wrong with this exhibition that he was involved in. And I believe I started with, well, for starters, they probably don't have eyes. When in fact they do. Carbon-based life forms probably do have eyes, but... they may see a completely different visual spectrum. They exist under different gravitational conditions.
It was etched, though, so arguably it wasn't like it was a painted picture.
True, true. But there were paintings and films that were, you know, encoded on this new incarnation of the project.
Yeah, and effectively television broadcast format.
Mm. Yes, yes.
Analog. That I found really interesting.
But so besides... besides the practicalities of whether they can figure out how to drop a needle on a phonograph record, what are the other problems with how we imagine humanoid English-speaking little green men?
Well, there was, apart from a few of the... I think there's greetings from the president and so on. I don't think there's that much English on it. So they, you know, lots of little... trying to describe things in minimalist binary form. They're really obsessed with the... what is it? Transitions... time of the hydrogen atom for a universal unit of measurement. So some of that sounds quite interesting and kind of plausible. The idea of it being in a record form for the Voyager probes is a little bit quaint, but it's kind of what they had to deal with at the time. And it was just kind of, well, we're sending this thing out there, we may as well put something on it. And actually, I kind of like the idea of it because it's just physically out there, whereas there were other attempts where there were, I mean, none of them were really taken that seriously, but actual radio missions. And at least there's this going to, at some point, be this, like, derelict space probe floating around in space somewhere that someone might randomly bump into. But the idea that you're sending a radio transmission to a galaxy 25,000 years away that's 3 minutes long. So at some point, 25,000 years from now, if someone just happens to be listening to exactly the right frequency for those 3 minutes, then they'll go, oh, there was someone out there. But at least, you know, the physical object will endure a little bit longer. So it's still a wacky numbers game. But at least, yeah, I don't know. It just seems that your chances are slightly higher.
Is that still the basis of SETI at the moment, sending beams out, or is it more of a listening?
SETI is entirely passive. There's a separate kind of active SETI branch, but SETI, I don't think, actually does active SETI. And they call it METI, so sending messages out to space.
Right.
There have been a few attempts at messages, but none of them are taken extraordinarily seriously. In fact, I was looking into the Arecibo message, one of the first really serious ones. It was such a marketing attempt that it was basically the Arecibo telescope opened and they needed to do something amazing with it. So they concocted this message with this binary code and everything. And then they sent it out at basically the star that it happened to be pointing to, because the Arecibo telescope is basically just built into the ground. You can't really move it around very much and have much choice about where it's going. Go, oh, look, there's a star. That's the one we're sending it to. And in fact, actually, because it's like 25,000 years away, they would have needed to lead their shot for it actually to hit that star. So it's actually going to miss it. But, you know, it looks a lot better on, you know, your press release. If you go, like, here's our crosshairs and here's, like, M13. We're shooting our message out there. But actually, we're going to miss it by a massive amount because, you know, stuff takes a long time to move at the speed of light when the universe is so ridiculously large.
That's a great story. I didn't know that. I didn't know that it was a big marketing exercise. But it does highlight the fact that even this attempting to contact aliens is itself a cultural artifact aimed pretty much entirely at us.
Yeah, exactly.
So even the record, the idea, it doesn't matter that the aliens aren't going to be able to listen to the record or understand anything that's on it. It's really about us making the gesture. It's really about the thought of someone overtaking that record, you know, in 100 years' time or 1,000 years' time or whatever. Or we die out, but that's still going. There's still part of us still out there. It doesn't really need anybody else to hear it. I mean, it's exciting to think that somebody might one day hear our works of art, you know, whether they're in the expanding bubble of our radio emissions right now, which are about to go quiet because now we're all digital and all terrestrial-based. All those transmissions are going to stop.
Thank God. They must be so relieved.
Yeah. <That's right. laughs> But if we were making a serious attempt to contact aliens, I don't know that it would be possible. I think it's a bit like science fiction writers attempting to seriously imagine what an alien might be like. I think as soon as you apply that sort of restriction of serious on it, everything kind of stops because we don't have enough data. Until you know what the aliens might be like, how do you imagine a medium that will be universal? I mean, I wrote a story once called... the title's a weird one because it was given to me as a dare. The Jackie Onassis Swamp Buggy Concerto. And in this sort of slight trivial story, I imagine that the only thing that would be universal because it relies on harmonics and ratios and stuff is music and pitch. So there's telepathic aliens that use music as a carrier wave. But that is absurd, you know. But whatever it is that will be the universal medium, it's probably something that would seem absurd to us at the moment because we don't know enough. But that doesn't stop us from trying. I think it's really important to try and really important to imagine.
And we're hampered by the vacuum of space and relativity and all kinds of fairly brutal walls.
The lack of vacuum in space, that's the trouble. I mean, there's so much hydrogen. If you want to go far enough to actually reach another, to get a large enough sort of volume of space that will maximise your chances of hitting any civilization or wandering spaceship that might be out there, you start to hit the absorption spectra of the hydrogen and other crap that's kind of floating in the vacuum, and it soaks up any kind of weak signal very, very quickly. So our bubble of transmissions that's spreading out to space right now isn't going to go very far because it's so diffuse and so strange.
That's what I found so weird about the fact that the initial SETI, the very first attempts, which actually by Drake of the Drake Equation, is around that frequency, like the emission frequency of hydrogen. It's a little bit like going, I don't know, I'm a nerd, so set up wireless networks really often. You search around and try and find an empty area of space to transmit into. It's like they did the exact opposite. They went, wow, there's like this massive hum coming out of the universe around where, you know, hydrogen's emission frequency. Let's look for transmissions around there in the busiest possible place. And they transmitted things in the same kind of frequency, which just seems a little bit weird. But then it's really hard to imagine, like, if you were just randomly going to tune in a radio to listen to someone, what frequency would you tune to? And if you don't have any of our culture to build on, you haven't heard all these 107.1 ads, you have no idea what frequency you should be listening to. So it's very hard to pick one. And that's really the problem of, like, intentionally trying to contact aliens. In fact, I even saw a while ago, or quite a long time ago, another kind of active SETI project was the co-SETI project, which was the argument that if there was, like, some kind of interstellar communication, they wouldn't actually use radio frequency, they'd probably use photons because they're much more directed. You're not wasting as much energy flying off elsewhere. So they started looking a little bit like what the Kepler thing does now. They're looking at stars for little oscillations in the light, which might be light transmissions that were being targeted directly at us, which is very unlikely. But if they were trying to, that's probably a much more efficient way of doing it.
The co-SETI stuff's amazing, and it's amazing in its scope. So you basically build... one way of doing it is building a shield like 1,000 times bigger than the Earth. So when it passes in front of the sun, so your sun and the sun, people you're trying to communicate with are in a straight line once a year or whatever, this shield kind of swings in front and you, I don't know, make it go transparent in odd kind of ways. So it modulates the light of the star. So we at the other end can possibly see it.
Like a crude sort of semaphore across the galaxy.
It's like semaphore. But if you do it across long enough time spans, if you're an alien that lives for a billion years, you know, that's a very powerful way of transmitting information in one direction every now and again, you know. But it could work. Or pulsars, you know, is another way as well. If you can modulate those kind of beams, you know, it's That's the trouble. You know, we're tiny and we're new, and we're only just starting to beginning to imagine this stuff. If you're trying to imagine communicating with an alien species that's been around for a million years, they're not going to be communicating by records anymore. You know, whatever we imagine now, they'll have forgotten.
That's part of the problem that sometimes I see about the idea of, like, are we wasting our time? Is it quaint and naive to think that it's even worthwhile contacting another intelligence? Why is there that need for one intelligence to find the other?
Well, yeah, as I was discussing with you earlier, it's interesting to think about the fact that that desire to communicate with another intelligence might be something that isn't actually that common in the universe. Mm-hmm. There might be things that we would consider to be intelligent life that are kind of like, other civilizations. They're like, we've got our own thing going on here. It's pretty awesome. You can come if you want, but we're not really that interested in you dudes. So it could be like that.
And Arthur C. Clarke's huge black monolith springs to mind. Clearly they have an interest in us. They're amused by the idea of a fellow intelligent life form, but they have to give it a kick along with this mysterious black obelisk.
For us to be worth talking to.
Yes.
I guess, you know, they're doing all this
uplifting. It's a flattering idea. Are we flattering ourselves? Yeah,
that's right.
It's interesting, like, the way you train an animal in a way so that you can commune with it a little bit more like you're used to communing with other humans.
Yeah.
And that's a little bit the same kind of idea. I mean, when you stumble across a lizard while you're walking along a fire track, your brain is sort of telling you, oh, look, he's cute, and I wish I could be like Dr. Doolittle and talk with him and stuff. But it's probably just going, is he going to step on me or is he food?
Yeah.
And but you are...
Where'd that shadow come from?
Yeah. Cats have no interest in us either.
Exactly.
They're like houses. They're
like houses. But we're projecting all those ideas on it. And actually, and when we train pets, we're sort of trying to almost humanize them in order to make it easier for us to interact with them.
We're stuck in this filter again, aren't we? We're, it's impossible to imagine what point there is to something except for a point, whatever point there is that we think there is. That's a terrible sentence. Did that make any sense at all?
I'm vaguely holding on.
Yeah, that's right. You know, we think it's important to reach out and communicate to aliens. Do we need a reason bigger than that? But, of course, the aliens may not see it the same way. As you say, they might see us waving over here going, hello, hello, and either ignore us or send a million battleships to come out and destroy us because we're being too noisy, you know, or something in between, or something that we can't imagine because they're not human.
So we'll just mark that frequency of the spectrum and keep broadcasting on as, like, those guys.
It would be supremely irritating, wouldn't it? If you're in the vacuum of space and you're digging the silence, and then there's all these, you know, humanoid flesh robots yelling at you.
Well, there is that wonderful story. Who wrote that wonderful story called They're Made of Meat?
They're made of meat. Indeed.
Rudy.
It does point to a bias that we all suffer from.
Jerry Bisson, thank you.
In that we are kind of meat-centric. We assume that it has to be carbon-based, that we have to find this Goldilocks exoplanet. Mm. And so the Drake equation, for example, is the probability or the statistical likelihood of there being a certain number of these Earth-like planets outside of our solar system.
Thought experiment in an equation, yeah.
But can we not conceive of an alien that exists as a cloud of energy or... in some permanent state of flux in the interior of a star, or why are we stuck on humanoid carbon-based things like that? In your search for fictional intelligent life, have you come across anything that is the furthest from carbon-based?
Well, there are ultra-intelligent shades of blue. To quote Douglas Adams, there are stars that are intelligent. There are whole galaxies that are intelligent. Some people think that the entire universe is an intelligent being. Science fiction, the great thing about science fiction is anything that you can possibly imagine can be put into a story any way you like. You don't have to necessarily be scientifically accurate. And
sentient rocks, just to annoy cognitive scientists.
Yeah, that's right. Or you know, the sky's the limit, literally. You know, and also the exact opposite. I mean, we don't have to go to other planets to imagine alien beings. I mean, one of my favourite ideas for aliens are the ultra-terrestrials of Keeling, the what was that movie that came out a few years ago? The owls. Ah, damn it. Anyway, the aliens. What we see when we see UFOs and ghosts aren't in fact machines from outer space or dead humans. They are terrestrials, beings that live on Earth, but they live just a little bit off from our reality. So instead of being extraterrestrials, they're ultra-terrestrials. And every now and again, our planes of existence kind of overlap. And they may be massively huge and incomprehensible beings to us that don't really notice us at all. Or they could be the other way around. They could be like the lizard on the path going, what the hell are these things? Or there could be a whole all manner of ultra-terrestrials living right here on Earth. And I think that's an absolutely brilliant idea.
That is a wonderful idea. The idea of us
the Mothman
wasting
prophecies.
All of this expense to find something that looks just like us.
Yeah.
Whereas, in fact, if we were to only tweak ever so slightly, we could find them all around us.
Hmm.
Speaking of annoying cognitive scientists, though, we should probably ask a question about modalities of consciousness and whether it's even possible for one type of consciousness to comprehend or communicate with another. Pix, do you have any ideas along those lines?
Well, as I say, like, jammed in between the gaps of my computer science degree, I did philosophy and cognitive science, but because of that, I'd say I don't know anything about consciousness. The only thing that I learned is that no one really knows what's going on, but a lot of people think they'll know it when they see it.
Like porn.
Yeah, maybe. So for some people, the Pioneer plaque was awesome. Yeah, but it's always tricky to extrapolate from this data point of one, especially when we don't even really have that data point yet. Like, what is it that makes us conscious? What is it that we would say, no, that definitely isn't conscious and this is? And where would you start to get that line in a meaningful sense that you could start extrapolating into what other kinds of consciousnesses are? And if you decide to just cut down consciousness to just the idea of being aware that you are an entity, then immediately you've already gotten down to this very specific idea of personal identity. Whereas imagine, like, you know, we sort of think about very enlightened Buddhists, we don't think that they're not people, right? But these people, if you can imagine if someone was as enlightened as possible, they might be really uninterested in the idea of personal identity.
Mm.
If we stumbled across a consciousness that was like basically like an entire civilization of extraordinarily enlightened Buddhists who weren't interested in the idea of identity, would we sort of go, well, this isn't really conscious because they're not really that fussed about awareness of themselves as being individual identities. Yet that's actually something we hold in a certain amount of esteem here. Yet actually, when we're talking about what is consciousness, that particular group that we'd hold in esteem would actually not really think consciousness was anywhere near as interesting as we thought it was.
Mm. There's a wonderful novella called The Things by Peter Watts. Peter Watt. And it's a riff on The Thing, the John Carpenter The Thing, which is originally based on Who Goes There. And it speaks to this issue because he retells the story of The Thing. Does everybody here know The Thing? Antarctica base, yeah, takes over one by one. His take on it is that the Thing comes from a wider galactic culture where identity is something that is very, very fluid. So you meet someone, you physically exchange and absorb their notion of identity, so you become wider and grander as a person, as a functioning being in the society. So when this creature crash lands on Earth, wakes up, sees us, it perceives us as beings similar to ones he's seen before, but with a terrible tumour at the top of its brain stem that has kind of completely subsumed all the normal biological reactions, which is to, you know, adopt and adapt and exchange, and to believe in this thing that of a singular consciousness. And so it proceeds to liberate all of us diseased aliens by mind-raping itself into all of us. And it's such a convincing, compelling way of looking at identity, our notions of
it
identity.
It is very convincing, isn't it?
Yeah, it's great.
The idea that individuality is perhaps the source of all of our problems, and if there is some other species that's far enough advanced out there, they've transcended individuality. They all just get along. Isn't that nice?
Birds and flowers.
But it's also kind of sinister and terrifying. Like, you know, the Borg collective from Star Trek, for example.
Well, it's sinister to us. And I don't think Peter Watts is making a value judgment, which I think is what makes it such a clever story. I think to us it seems absolutely terrifying. To it seems like it's doing us a favour. And I think to the Borg, they're doing the universe a favour, you know.
Yeah.
Why not?
They're not the bad guys.
It kind of
them.
It kind
the
of reminds you.
No one thinks they're the bad guy, right?
Yeah, it's a thought experiment that you could take to life after death as well. Mm. I mean, there's, you know, a lot of people subscribe to the idea that all of our consciousnesses are identical and they eventually rejoin the pool when our physical selves, you know, rot away, which is a nice idea, but also a terrifying idea. The idea of losing your identity. It's kind of a double-edged kind of consolation.
Is that the same thing as being alive? You know, if we lose our identity as humans and beings, is that the same thing as being alive?
Well, I think that gets back to Pinker's cheesecake situation.
Mm.
He sort of...
The cheesecake crisis.
Yes, he dismisses human culture and spirituality or our ideas of art and individuality as incidental cheesecake or porn, but really it's...
it's
something inherently valuable. You kind of find yourself talking into a circle where you find, no, these things really are valuable. They make us human, quote unquote.
Well, I think you're probably getting off on a tangent by focusing on that again, but when I was reading that, the main thing that I picked up from there is, I mean, a lot of people would argue that basically since we've developed culture and language and all this kind of stuff, that effectively the amount that we evolve in an evolutionary sense is pretty much stopped compared to the amount that we evolve in a social sense.
Mm.
And so for all of its cheesecakiness, that's basically the way we evolve as a culture now.
That is what's driving our progress. It's no longer natural selection, but...
It's like, sure, it doesn't have anything to do with evolution anymore, but evolution is pretty much, that's like so 10,000 years ago.
Well, maybe it does. I mean,
now we're all about the cheesecake.
Maybe it's not genetic evolution anymore, or evolution via genes, it's evolution via memes.
Yes, exactly, so, memetic evolution, which is entirely cheesecake-based.
I think it's easy to imagine aliens that are exactly like us. You know, lots of shows have done that, lots of books have done that. And it's also very simple to just say, well, they're never going to be like us at all. And I think it's the area in between, the grey area, that will keep us having conversations like this and writing science fiction for thousands of years until we finally meet aliens. And of course, once we meet one other set of aliens...
Until we find the meat aliens. Until we finally meet aliens.
But of course, once we meet one set of aliens that are in between the two extremes, then you've really got a Venn diagram with our culture and their culture with an overlap in the middle, probably. But then... We'll always wonder what the next set of aliens will be like. You know, what will that set of Venn diagrams be like? And will there be a common ground where all three of us can meet up and eat cheesecake or watch porn or whatever the equivalent of those things are with three cultures? And it's a little bit like, to a lesser extreme, what it's like living on Earth like now. I mean, we have Australians who are broken down into various subcultures. We have the idea of humanity, which is broken down to various cultures, both, you know, different countries, but also different ways of being. Like, is somebody who suffers from schizophrenia the same as somebody who is heteronormative or somebody who is autistic? Does that qualify as meeting somebody who has an alien sense of identity, or somebody who's born profoundly disadvantaged? I mean, is that a different kind of being? What about dolphins? What about bonobos? What about grasshoppers and crickets? You know, right here on Earth, there are all sorts of alien perspectives that we share some kind of overlap with, or maybe none. You know, maybe we share.
Where's all of the grasshopper perspective on human fiction?
Well, you know, maybe
it's a valid, not really external, but alternate perspective. Why are we so fascinated with the alien perspective where there are a whole bunch of other perspectives?
I mean, because there's a level of grandeur. Yeah,
I guess so.
There's a goal, like that story that I sent you gentlemen before. There's a famous Isaac Asimov short story called The Final Question, or The Last Question.
No spoilers, I haven't read it.
Yeah. which is ultimately about the human race creating a machine or a computer that evolves to a point at which it itself becomes a kind of advanced alien life form that solves humanity's problems right up until the heat death of the universe. You can't really get to that stage when you're looking at Watership Down or grasshoppers. I think it's an idea of there being hope once the sun goes nova. It's the idea of humans or some kind of intelligence enduring after the heat death of the universe, which is kind of hopeful but also a terrifying thing to try and think about.
Mm. Death of our solar system, I can imagine, but enduring beyond the heat death of the universe is a big call.
Bit of a struggle, yeah.
Bit of a stretch.
I've set a scene there. In a Doctor Who story.
Yes.
Does that count?
I assume it's towards the end.
Sorry? It's the very final scene of the story.
Not the opening chapter. Yeah.
No. He's only there briefly.
I wonder if it's time to open it up to the audience.
Alien perspectives on this question.
Feel free to. We are recording this session for the radio, and eventually beaming into Alpha Centauri. So there is a microphone in the middle there.
Oh, it wasn't just that they had to keep their criticism polite.
Yes, well, there's that. Yes, thank you, in the front row there.
Oh, hi. I grew up in the era when we went to see Eric von Daniken in the cinema and...
Hubcaps of the Gods.
Pardon?
Hubcaps of the Gods.
Cheesecakes of the Gods.
Yes, yes. And I'm wondering what your perspective is on perhaps we're all just an alien experiment, and that if we do encounter an alien culture, would they not see us as an equal or a threat, but as we treat the animals perhaps these days, as something as breeders or slaves or, yeah... That sort of
I think it's extraordinarily unlikely that we'll meet aliens that are on exactly on our scale of intelligence right now, just because it's so hard for people like us to get to other people like us a long way away. So chances are, if we meet any of them soon, be them ultra-terrestrials or guys in flying ships, and whether they've been here before, there's going to be a huge power imbalance and we're likely to come out of it the wrong way.
I think it's a really great question, because we haven't touched on, you know, the potential hostility of an alien civilization. Is it, I mean, ridiculous conjecture, I'm sure, but what's the likelihood of them having any interest at all in what we have? If they're capable of travelling across the galaxy, why on earth would they want iron ore?
That's right.
Or, you know...
It's booming!
Yeah. Commodity prices are soaring.
In Alpha Centauri.
Yeah.
It's a wonderful novel by...
It is such an important thing. You know, it's such a trope in science fiction, that conquering alien races.
Well, Ian Watson, who's a British writer, wrote a wonderful novel back in the late 70s, I think, called The Embedded. And it's about exactly this, where advanced aliens stumble across Earth. And these aliens drift from place to place, basically... trading knowledge, and they look at humans and go, you haven't got much, really, you know. Give us all your songs, all your books, all your plays, all your movies,
cheesecake,
and maybe we'll give you the perfect recipe for the best cheesecake in the universe, you know. That's it. And then at the same time, this is happening on one level of the story. There's this linguist who's working with autistic kids, I think, on embedded languages, which is a particular grammatical kind of concept that is impossible for humans to understand once it gets to a certain degree of embeddedness. And he kind of cracks, he raises these kids in a particular way that they can understand embedded language. And when the aliens get wind of this, they go, you can have the lot if you give us that. So, you know, it's a minor experiment, small funding, whatever, trivial to us. To aliens, it's like crack. You know, and it may just be like that. If we may, there may be something small here that's conceptual rather than physical, that they may be looking for or may need, or maybe they just like Kylie Minogue's back catalogue and they like pop music, or, you know, it'll be something cultural, I think, cultural or conceptual, I think, because you're quite right, they're not coming here for our water or our iron.
I think there's when I was looking into the Voyager disc, there's a story about a bunch of aliens that come to Earth because they find the disc and they go, they've got so much gold! Because it's gold-plated to stop it rusting and so on.
It's hilarious.
Yeah. And I mean, assuming gold is like, well, it's not extraordinarily rare. It's relatively abundant. It's just hard to find in big lumps.
That's right. I think it's hilarious that all these science fiction movies at the moment, all the aliens are coming here to get our water. I mean, it's so transparently reflecting our own concerns about the future. And I think that's brilliant, but it's also slightly hilarious, you know.
Yeah, actually, because the only thing really, like when they're looking for the Goldilocks zone, it's only liquid water that's hard to find.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you take non-liquid water from somewhere else and take it to somewhere that's room temperature, you've got liquid water magically.
Yeah. Aliens never thought of that.
No. Just,
yes,
we just need to build a heater.
I really admit that I'm not a sci-fi person, but I find it fascinating from the perspective that we always assume, or a lot of people always assume, that if we meet some other life form, that it's going to impact on us in a negative way. And yet, when we talk about becoming more advanced human beings, we talk about getting to a point that we actually all get on, and that we all, you know, care about one another and all of this stuff. And yet, when we talk about aliens, want of a better term, we assume that it's going to have a negative impact on us. I'm wondering why.
That's quite interesting. From, like, Stephen Hawking is actually one of the proponents of, if they're anything like us, we're screwed. So yeah, let's just keep it on the down low. None of this sending messages out into outer space. But yeah, then when you like, if looking at the way the Drake equation falls together, which is just this equation sort of basically outlining all of the problems and statistical unlikelihoods there are of finding another civilization. And just by looking at that, the way they describe it, it's not like you have to find. I'll just go through the whole thing. It's not that crazy. Like, what's the rate of planets being stars being created in the universe? How many of those stars have planets? How many planets are around those stars? How many of those planets produce life? And they immediately jump to intelligent life. And then it's intelligent life that starts producing technology that we can detect from a distance. And then how long would those different civilizations exist for? And they sort of, you know, the number doesn't actually really matter. It's more about just thinking about all of those individual different steps. It's interesting because some of the ones at the beginning, we're learning that the numbers are getting higher all the time as we do science. But anyway,
there are more and more exoplanets.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like way more than we thought there were. Almost maybe like there's probably one around every star. But at the moment, it's like, you know, it's still growing all the time when they're doing their estimates. But anyway, I'm just trying to remember how I got onto that tangent. But yeah, it's about... but also, when they talk about that, so those last couple of terms, like, it's a planet that gets technology to the point where we can detect it, right? So we start imagining, and actually Jill Tanner, who runs SETI, talks in her TED Talk, she's really out there about what they're actually intending to look for. They're not like, oh, you know, we want to see if they've got a TV show that was a little bit like ALF, right? Like, they're not expecting to pick up their radio emissions. They want to see, you know, intergalactic communications systems, asteroid avoidance systems, the kind of things that would be powered on the level that they would emit enough radiation for us to see, electromagnetic radiation for us to see. So they're pretty much assuming that anything we hear about is going to be crazily advanced. So it is a bit weird for someone to imagine that we're going to run into a bunch of like spacefaring savages. It could of course happen, but it's hard to imagine that. Like they're talking about the kind of species that we might run into would be like they would already have to have lived for a ridiculously long time just statistically for us to have run into them. Like you were saying, we're not going to run into anyone like us because we're not likely to run into anyone like us. Mm. So it's hard to imagine that a civilization would have gotten to the level where they're just hopping around planets, and yet they have all this internal turmoil and they destroy everything in their path. But it's really hard. If we're extrapolating from a data point of one, yeah, we probably are screwed if they're anything like us. But we're hoping that they're not.
Every time we've seen one superior culture encounter an inferior culture in the entirety of our history, the inferior culture is always just completely rooted.
Yes.
Even if the culture just changes, they've lost something, you know. So I think it's probably inevitable.
But don't you think there's a difference?
Yes.
Absolutely, yes. I guess it's an optimistic idea that your morals advance at the same rate as your technology, but that's not necessarily what we've seen down here.
Though, you know, maybe. I mean, they do say that we're less violent than
that is
but
true,
that's just one measure of immorality, of course. So maybe we've found more subtler, less violent ways to screw each other over. I don't know.
Sorry, this lady's been waiting for some time.
And we forgot the microphone.
being small. Okay. Sorry, I didn't mind if you wanted to continue what was going on there, because I was enjoying that.
No, all these threads will come back.
I was quite taken by the last point that you made before you opened it up to question time, which was the concept of why are we looking out there when we haven't actually even solved anything about communication down here. And so, for instance, actually mooted the idea that it was grand, but actually it's not. I don't think it's because it's a grand idea. I think it's because it's a big unknown, and we're all excited by the big exotic. For some reason, we think we know everything down here, but in fact, we don't. We don't know even how to communicate with each other half the time. And, you know, whether it's even in your own family, people next door in another country, and certainly between other animal species. And I think that we still... Sorry, a bit ethical. I still think that we need to concentrate a lot more on the other animal species down here about communicating with them. It's not necessarily making them more human, but they tune into us quite... You know, they're obviously more, in some levels, have that different intelligence that they can work out what the hell we're saying, but we haven't got a clue what's going on over there, so to speak. I just think that why don't we make more effort now about understanding other creatures and getting along with people, and in that broadest philosophical sense, people, anyone who has an identity, no matter what animal you are, than worrying about people out there.
I think you're quite right, but I think we are making the effort. I think, well, this is part of making that effort. More so. I know, that's right, but you don't know where the answer will lie. And maybe asking this question will help us find an answer to that problem, or maybe...
A form of reflection, you mean.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So it's really the thought experiment, thinking about what it would be like for us to realise that we're not alone, there are other cultures, maybe... We could unify as a culture because now we want to communicate with this other culture, or you know, it would start to. We would, you know, it's unfortunately you see it all the time in science fiction where humanity is united against a common enemy. Hopefully, it wouldn't be that, but you know, united in the sight of this knowledge about that there is this other that we're all other from.
Well, the idea that we're being watched. Like, look, busy. Jesus is coming.
Exactly. <Yeah.
laughs> We better behave.
I mean, we haven't.
Like intergalactic candid camera, Earth edition.
How embarrassing that would be for us to finally realize, oh my God, they've seen, they saw the Holocaust.
They saw the whole bit.
You know,
but we're assuming that they care.
Well,
and
that's
that they
true.
Would make an ethical judgment, and that they have ethics.
Well, it's more that we care. Like, it's really often that we are concerned about. Things that people might see about ourselves, but we're more concerned that they see it. They probably don't care at all.
We are making really interesting headways in using machine intelligence to understand language of alien cultures, such as languages that existed thousands of years ago, and mysterious texts like the Voynich manuscript, however you pronounce it. And we're now applying those tools to dolphin languages and other languages, and in the hope of cracking open that great secret of speaking to consciousness on our own planet. And I think that's very exciting, alongside SETI. You know, they're possibly the two most interesting sort of cultural experiments happening in the world at the moment.
I think that's very interesting, and linguistics itself is a very fascinating topic. And I would hope, though, that people start using those languages to interact, and not like we have when we've cracked the code of understanding other human languages, which we use then to control those other people often. Sorry.
I think we have time for one very quick question after that.
This one's going to be might be a curly one. even though the jury's out on this one when it comes to human beings, how likely are aliens to be altruistic?
Well, we're coming back to that question of higher intelligence equaling living on a higher moral plane. Do they necessarily go together?
Well, the thing, obviously... it depends on... Oh, no, we get into ethical relativism. I'm sorry. Please un-ask the question.
Can we do ethical relativism? Can we do evolutionary psychology and ethical relativism in 3 minutes?
Yeah, because, I mean, well, yeah, there are different... Like, yeah, you could have altruism that really screwed up some people, I guess, in a weird way. Because, I mean, the thing story totally thought it was being entirely altruistic, but was ill-informed. But only from our perspective...
And what if aliens are actually machines?
What if, sorry?
Aliens are actually machines.
Well, there's a good chance we'll all be machines before long. So it's quite likely that when humanity encounters another species, it may be machines talking to each other.
And in what way are we not machines at the moment?
That's right. We're all cyborgs.
It's just nanotech that we don't quite understand yet.
we do look very different. We would look very alien to... the vast majority of generations that came before us, you know.
But it would be fascinating if we just found... We didn't have all of the trouble of dealing with an actual civilization that might want to kill us, but if we just stumbled across an artifact like their Voyager, we don't have to worry about all the messiness of them, you know, coming and colonizing our planet. We would just know with that one item, oh my God, where'd this come from?
Well, that's one of the things that we haven't really touched on enough, I think, is the culture shock that will be associated with that realization.
Just if there was a nice way to do it, if we were lucky enough to have the realization without all of the unknown scariness that would happen. But all we'd have to deal with is how does it change us as a people? Like, we don't, you know, okay, maybe there'd be some fancy technology in there that we wouldn't understand. But it's completely aside from that. It's literally just a crappy Voyager probe, but it's got, hey, we're aliens on it. But there's nothing really interesting technologically. It doesn't really change us technologically. All it does is makes us all realise that there's something else out there. And that's, I think, the whole idea of SETI is just so that we can have that. We can try and project and imagine what it would be like. to suddenly have this different perspective.
I think I agree with Paul Davies when he said the other night that if they do get a confirmed signal through SETI, the media will go berserk for a week. And then life will just continue as normal, because in a way we're kind of used to alien perspectives, and whether it's a different perspective from somebody else in Adelaide or in Japan or on another planet, you know, does it really change the way we go through life as individuals, because we're surrounded by aliens?
No. It's just straight, and also it would straight be back to cheesecake. Yeah. Okay. Meanwhile, yeah, unfortunately we have to leave it there. My thanks to this wonderful crowd, extraordinary, and to our guests, Mr. Stephen Pickles.
Thank you, thank you.
This session of the 2013 Adelaide Festival of Ideas was recorded by Radio Adelaide through the support of the Bar Smith Library, University of Adelaide, the University of South Australia Library, and Flinders University Library.